You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston talking wa, no mai haere mai ki te wā mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday, the 23rd of August. I'm your host, Jemima, and I am here all locked down because the news team is working hard at home to bring you the latest in current events and news. Today, I am looking after Jessica and Louie's show, who have been producing their pieces from home today. This week on the show, Jessica speaks to Amnesty International Community Manager Margaret Taylor about their petitions against the death penalty in Iran. Louis has got quite a few pieces on the way for you today. So he speaks firstly to Dr. Jin Russell from the University of Auckland about her poverty and child development research. He then goes on to speak to Children's Commissioner Andrew Beecroft about the recent approval for 12 to 15-year-olds to receive the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. He also speaks to Auckland City Mission's Deb Ward, who speaks about what it has been like for the mission during the latest lockdown. And finally, independent journalist Neha Wadekar speaks about the Cabo Delgado conflict in Mozambique. So, some really good pieces coming up for you today, and awesome work by Jessica and Louie, who have been very prompt today with making sure they get their stuff through to me, which is amazing. Ko we e wareware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, he pakihiri rokiroki, maronga i te pae tukutuku o Ararangi Pōhō, mi haere ki 95BFM Irakati Katikom. You can catch all of these stories on the show today and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. Head to the BCasts page and then head to the Wire link, and you can see all the work the news team is doing over this lockdown period there. So check it out. You can also head to our social media, which is 95BFM News on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Give us a follow, give us a like, and we will be posting some updates about some cool podcasts and some of the best bits on during this lockdown period. So if that's easier for you, that's another place you can find us. And also, it's locked down, it's just me in here, so send me through a text. 5395 is the number, or give me a call in studio. 309-3879 is the phone number. So let me know what you think of the pieces on the show today, because it's just me and we love hearing what you've got to say. Anyway, let's crack into the show.
Irirangi Pōhō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Amnesty International New Zealand recently delivered three petitions with 19,300 signatures to the Iranian embassy in Wellington. These petitions call for an end to the execution of child offenders and also highlight human rights abuses against women and those who defend people on death row. Jessica spoke to Amnesty International Community Manager Margaret Taylor, who is asking for New Zealand to play a part in speaking out against this. She started the interview by asking Margaret about what events Amnesty's petitions focus on.
The global rules that say the death penalty should never apply to those who commit crimes as children. So right there, that's the key concern that Amnesty International has with the death penalty in Iran. But actually, we're totally opposed to the death penalty anyway. It is a revenge, not a justice-based action, and it fails to address concerns. You know, it fails to stop crime, it fails to stop drug abuse, that kind of thing, so it doesn't even work.
And can you tell our listeners a bit about the three petitions that Amnesty International has delivered to the Iranian embassy in Wellington and what these focus on?
Sure. So we handed over almost 20,000 signatures from concerned New Zealanders calling on the Iranian government to stop executing child offenders. But also we wanted to call on the Iranian government to respect women's rights, and particularly those women human rights defenders who have spoken out and are currently in detention. So they include Nazan Sotoudeh, who is a high-profile and world-famous lawyer who works every day to protect and promote human rights, but her voice is silenced because she is in prison, facing 38 years in prison for doing her job. But we also have darling Yasmin Ariani, who is, along with another Monterey, a few years ago, they just walked through a train carriage full of women. And Yasmin wasn't wearing a hijab, which you have to do. It's compulsory in Iran. And her mum was wearing a hijab. The point they were trying to make was whether you wear a hijab or not, it should be your right to do so. So she, the pair of them are facing 6 years in prison simply for challenging, you know, the right to wear what they wish to wear in Iran.
And can you speak at all to the sort of the background and the history that has led to this treatment of children and women in Iran?
Look, I think the history just increasingly over since the Shah was toppled and a religious leadership was put into place. It has been a very regressive leadership because it has repressed human rights, whether that be freedom of expression, whether that be the ability to speak out and criticise. Iranians certainly don't have free and fair elections. They just voted for in a new president, but so many of their people couldn't vote. And the new president is Ibrahim Raisi, who is a former head of the judiciary, but Amnesty is calling for him to be investigated for crimes against humanity. So, you know, it's like decades now of a repressive regime, and every step of the way, people who do speak out have been targeted, and particularly those people who might come from an ethnic or religious minority, and certainly more recently, as the good people of Iran are protesting, peaceful protest has been met with crackdowns that have seen thousands of people, including children, killed.
And how long has this sort of treatment been going on in the country, or has this just been happening recently, or have we only just been hearing about it recently?
No, well, I guess Amnesty International has been campaigning for rights to be respected in Iran for decades. I think that some people might have never heard of what's going down in Iran, but certainly it's issues that we have been consistently raising for decades now. And while some progress has been made, we have also seen a lack of progress in other areas. So, for instance, if you talk about the death penalty, Iran had a change of law that meant that people using drugs or abusing drugs should not face the death penalty any longer. And when that law was passed, it meant that the number of death sentences dropped, which is a good thing. But Iran still does have the death penalty, and it uses it inappropriately, and in fact it shouldn't be using it at all.
And globally, Amnesty International has said that there's been a trend away from the death penalty. So how has the international human rights community responded to these events in Iran?
Well, again, every community is different. People that will criticise... So Iran is regularly criticised for its human rights abuses. But, of course, there are very few countries with clean hands, actually. So human rights abuses are carried out by most countries. So the allies of Iran will stand up and support them, and the opponents of Iran will stand up and condemn them, and such is the way of the world. Our aspiration as Amnesty International is to say, you know, whether you're an ally or whether you're an opponent, you should be speaking out against the human rights abuses that Iran visits upon its own people.
And Amnesty International has delivered these petitions to the ambassador in Wellington. Do you believe that this is a priority issue for the ambassador?
Look, probably not, I'd say. It's up to us to make it a priority issue. And when you have close to 20,000 signatures, that highlights the deep concerns that are felt by New Zealanders. So that's why we were very keen to take those signatures with us, because they represented the concerns of so many New Zealanders. And it's up to us to keep the pressure on. And while we were on site, we did do a lot of social media posts and footage that we can use to raise concerns on social media about the Iranian government's actions. So it's up to us to keep the pressure on that way.
And what would Amnesty's calls for New Zealand be to support or condemn what's happening in Iran?
Sure. Well, as a country, New Zealand has long been an opponent of the death penalty, but it has long been a supporter of women's rights. So we set a good example on the global stage, and we would certainly encourage the New Zealand government, and we are aware that they do this in conversations with Iran, to follow the leadership that New Zealand has in both those arenas, actually. So I think it's important that they hear from us that there can be another way, and we're a shining example on both fronts.
That was Amnesty International New Zealand's community manager, Margaret Taylor, speaking to Jessica about petitions against the death penalty in Iran. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima. It's lockdown. That's why I'm here on a Monday. So tukapā tui mai, send me through a text 5395. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of the pieces on the show today. We'll be right back with some more good newsy bits for you after a short little break.
When the drum beats go like this. Pump up the volume, pump up the volume, pump up the volume.
This is a COVID-19 announcement. How to exercise at alert level 4. You can still exercise, but only if you're alone or with people in your bubble. Remember to stay within your neighbourhood and keep at least 2 metres away from others. Playgrounds are closed. You should also avoid places where people may gather. Make sure you avoid any exercise that could require emergency services if you got into trouble, like surfing or tramping. Unite against COVID-19.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Sheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
I'm disappointed by the government these days. Sometimes they just need a good kick in the backside.
The Wire.
You're back on The Wire on 95 BFM. University of Auckland's Dr. Jin Russell has recently completed her research into the impact of poverty on early childhood development. Russell claims that poverty can have considerable long-lasting impacts on a child's development. These impacts can influence their social skills, learning capabilities, and future job prospects. Louis was joined by Dr. Russell to talk about her study, its importance, and what changes she believes are needed. To start, he asked her to explain her research and how she became interested in the area.
So I work as a developmental paediatrician in Auckland, and one of the things that I've become very interested in is the impact of disadvantage, social disadvantage, and poverty on children's development. So in New Zealand, we know that poverty and disadvantage affects children's physical health. So for instance, children who grow up in households facing disadvantage, they tend to have higher risk of pneumonia and skin infections and rheumatic fever and all kinds of other health conditions that we see on the news. However, I became concerned, now we're going back about 10 years, I became concerned that children's development was also being affected by their early circumstances. And this seemed to be something that we see in the international literature around children in poverty. So I wanted to look at how poverty and social disadvantage affects children's development here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And I've studied this over the last few years using data from the Growing Up in New Zealand study, which is New Zealand's largest contemporary child cohort. The study has about 6,500 children and their families. The children are now aged 11. And I've used data from the children's early years, going up to from before birth through till just before the children went to school, to look at how poverty affects children's development.
Just specifically, would you be able to say how development differs from normal health outcomes?
Yeah, sure. So when we talk about physical health, we're talking about the children's, you know, their body, and that generally we're speaking about illnesses and diseases that affect children's physical bodies. But when we talk about development, we're talking about a set of skills and capabilities that children need to do well in life. These are things like a child's social-emotional development, how well they can regulate themselves emotionally, manage their own behaviour, how they recognise and emotions in other people, and how they respond socially. And then we're also talking about children's early learning skills. It taps into things like children's cognitive development and also their language and learning skills. So particularly how well children can focus and pay attention, and whether they've got the kinds of skills that you need when you start at school, the ability to sit and to learn and to attend and to take in new information. So that's what we're talking about with children's development.
So these early development skills that you speak of, how significant can they really be later in life, such as adult and teenagehood? What impact do they have?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So research from other studies, even studies here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, have shown that children's development has a massive impact on their later life outcomes. So the first thing to say is that there's a gradient in children's development. So for instance, there was a famous study that was conducted as part of the Dunedin cohort study, and it was published, I think, sometime in 2011 by the Dunedin researchers, and they had shown that there were what we call gradients in children's self-control abilities throughout childhood up till age 11. So starting from a very early age, I think something like age 3 up till age 11, there were gradients in children's self-control abilities. What that means is that if you take the whole population of children who are young and you look at the ones who have, you measure their self-control, what you'll find is that some children have a higher degree of self-control than other children. And they're able to delay gratification, for instance. And then they looked at children's later life outcomes, and they found that when these children had grown up and they were 38, they found that the kids who had higher levels of self-control when they were younger actually were doing better financially. They were doing better in terms of their physical health. They were more likely to be employed. So in general, they were doing better. And we see this finding actually plays out across a whole range of children's outcomes. So, for instance, children who have higher language skills when they're younger tend to do better at school, and that advantage amplifies over the school lifespan. And so by the time you leave school, children who've had really good language development early on tend to do better when they leave school, go on and get, jobs.
And just specifically, what are some of the... Because obviously poverty is quite a broad determinant, but what are some of the specific examples of things that impact early development?
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, when we talk about poverty, we're talking about specifically household income, and household income can have a direct impact on children's development. But the other things that are important are things like the mother's level of education. The mother's usually the one studied rather than father's, but we're pretty certain that fathers and mothers both have an impact. So mother's level of education is a really key determinant of children's overall development. Other factors as well are really important. So, for instance, whether or not the family speak English as their first language, that also seems to have a bearing on how well children do early on.
So what then do you think that the government should do? What changes would be the best things to implement to help improve these circumstances and conditions?
Yes, so great question. So there's a role for government to play. There's also a role for communities to play and community organisations. Specifically, the government can pull policy levers to improve household income for families. One of the reasons why I've looked at poverty is because poverty is a determinant of so many children's outcomes, and yet it's also exquisitely sensitive to policy changes. So, for instance, if you raise the household income of children who are at the lowest, experiencing the highest levels of disadvantage, and you raise them up so that their household income is more towards the median, you're going to see improvements in children's development, because that's what we see in every study. We see that there's this direct link between the household income of the family and how well the children are doing later on in school. So I think that the one of the major roles that the government can do is look at household income, and particularly a livable wage or a living wage would be fantastic. The other thing the government can do is put in place really great early child health screening systems, and we've got that at the moment with the government having reviewed the World Child Tamariki Ora developmental system and looking at how we can improve that so that it's more equitable.
That was University of Auckland's Dr. Jin Russell speaking on her recent research into the impacts of child poverty on cognitive development.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Last week, the government granted approval for children between 12 and 15 to receive the Pfizer vaccine. This comes after MedSafe gave the age bracket provisional approval in June, with other nations also agreeing that vaccinating 12 to 15-year-olds was safe. There are around 265,000 children in New Zealand who will now be eligible for vaccination against COVID-19. Louis spoke to Children's Commissioner Andrew Beecroft about the approval and the role of children in the COVID-19 vaccination program. He began by asking Andrew Beecroft why this decision has been made.
Oh, I think it's realised that children of that age are highly mobile. We've seen the way that outbreaks can occur in secondary schools. I think the medical protocols are now being carried out. Everything's entirely safe. And it's seen as an important tool in eliminating COVID in New Zealand. And I welcome it. I think it's fantastic. I think it's great for children.
Yeah, although you did say it's all entirely safe, but Jacinda Ardern said that Cabinet didn't make the decision lightly. Do you have any idea what the possible setbacks or, I guess, issues were with making this decision?
I'm not a paediatrician, least of all a health expert, but all that I've read is that the medical experts, the public health experts and the immunologists have checked things out, and the Pfizer vaccine that's been approved is considered in all respects safe. And for me, I go with that for me and my family and our community, and I agree with it.
So seeing as it has been approved now, what will be the process for getting kids 12 to 15 vaccinated? What's the consent around that? How do you go about it?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping that parents will, when they get vaccinated, take their children. I think that parents, I hope, will be encouraging their children to be vaccinated. They'll be talking about the fact that it's been approved, it's considered safe, that it's a responsible thing to do. And I'm not sure, actually, the details haven't been announced yet. Maybe it will be delivered and administered through schools. I'm just waiting that detail. But the good thing is that children are now also being prioritised and can get vaccinated. I hope that parents always see it as a positive thing to keep their children, their family and their community safe, and they will encourage vaccinations by those 12 and over.
Yeah, because I guess because it's consent through the parents, if there are parents who don't support vaccinations or something, are there issues around that?
Yeah, you're raising an interesting, I guess, hypothetical question. It's a complex area. I couldn't give a definitive answer, but for medical procedures that are routine and straightforward and minor, then parental consent, the consent of a guardian, usually isn't required. I, heaven help us, we don't want to get to that stage, but children 12, 13, 14, 15, where it's been carefully explained to them, where they know the health benefits, they're appraised of any risk, they're quite able to give consent. And I guess you could have a good argument as to whether this sort of procedure
is... So do you think that children between 12 and 15 should be involved in the vaccination process?
Absolutely. And I think they should be talked about it, and the discussion should start in their home, and they should be ready to go. There's good material on the Ministry of Health website. If children have any concerns, if parents have any concerns, that should be the starting point.
And education around these vaccines, especially COVID, do you think it's something that we should look at introducing in schools, in the curriculum, in the health system?
Yeah, in fact, I think the answer is yes to that, of course, but I think most children that I speak to know of the risks, know the benefits. They want to be socially responsible. They want to do their bit for the community. Most children that I've spoken to, all of them, know that it's something they want to do, say it's the right thing to do, and it's their way of helping. And they can encourage older members in their family to be vaccinated too. I think it's great now that all existing appointments, where there are for adults, where there are children, children can come along too. I mean, I think we're really going to speed things up. I think it's good. You just need to hear about how quickly things can spread in secondary school to realise that it's a good step.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to touch on, because especially the cases now and the cases previously, there's been a lot in colleges and in intermediates. Do you think that it's important then that this age group should have been vaccinated earlier, almost as a source of mitigation?
Yeah, well, that's an answer really for the policy experts. I'm not sure what was the delay, but clearly it was being well thought through, and we got to the stage where it's considered perfectly safe. But yes, children are highly mobile. They move around. We've heard from secondary schools that they've talked about everybody at the school should be considered a close contact because of the mobility of teenagers. So I think it's a good step in the overall aim to eliminate COVID.
Yeah, and one of the important points I saw Dr. Rauri Jansen brought up there, because Māori and Pacifica have much younger age structures, with almost 30% of their population under 16, vaccinating children is crucial to protecting wider whānau. Do you think that this was something that was factored into the decision-making?
I'm sure it was, and it's a very good point. And I think Māori and Pacifica communities are much younger on average. And if we're going to really prioritise those communities, then doing it through over 12s is a very good and effective way to do that. And that's why I think it's such a positive step. And indeed, I think younger Māori and Pacifica children are very good at advocating the benefits of it to their older family members.
Yeah, so I guess what I gather from the stuff you've said now is that almost one of the most important things for young people getting vaccinated and being educated about it is spreading information to the rest of the whānau. Is this something that you think should be prioritised, that sharing of information supporting vaccinations?
Yes, I do. And I actually think now that we're, as it were, on a compulsory family meal table, whānau time's important. I think whānau can talk about the issue, we can put it on the table, we can talk it through, we can say that it's been carefully looked at, researched, and that it is a positive step. I mean, these are discussions that can be had now within families and wider families. And I think that's something that we should all be talking about.
So for you, I guess, the role of children in New Zealand's COVID response is crucial.
Absolutely. And I think the step that's been taken prioritises the needs of children. I mean, children too are entitled to the highest possible standards of health. And I think this is a very principled and positive step and announcement for children. I think it's great. I welcome it. And children are, as we've said, sort of advocates and evangelists in the best sense for why vaccination is important. I think they'll be right behind it.
That was Children's Commissioner Andrew Beecroft speaking about vaccinating 12 to 15-year-olds. You're on The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima. I'm taking you through the hour while the news team is working hard at home to bring you the latest newsy bits. We've got another piece coming up shortly.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
As an essential service, the Auckland City Mission has continued to provide services during the current lockdown. However, Level 4 restrictions have changed how they can help those in desperate need. This includes takeaway food bags, social distancing, a pause for donations, and accommodation support. Auckland City Mission's fundraising and reputation manager, Deb Ward, joined Louie to talk about how lockdown impacts and changes the services of the mission. He began by asking how they were operating under Level 4.
So the Auckland City Mission has changed pretty much all of our services to ensure that we can provide service safely and well during Level 4 and not have to shut anything. So for example, we normally have a daily meal service, a sit-down hot breakfast meal service, which we clearly can't do because that's akin to a restaurant. So instead, we are providing really good takeaway bags for people every day. So they'll come eat daily, collect a bag, and be away, so that we're minimising the risk there. That's one of the key ways that we've changed. We've also changed through our, we're still going out onto the streets to check in on people and ensure their safety and wellbeing, but we're doing that at social distance. And doing visits to those that are in housing only when it's absolutely essential, whereas we'd normally go in 1-2 times a week. And then with our food parcels, we've already seen, as with every lockdown, we see a spike in the number of people needing support, and we've already seen that this lockdown. So with we've ramped up our services there, and that's through a phone consultation, and then when someone arrives to get their food parcels,
yeah,
one of our staff will pop that in their boot.
That's something I wanted to touch on, because the Auckland City Mission, I've seen they're not accepting donations at Level 4. For things for food parcels, where's it coming from?
On Tuesday, when we all got word that there might be a lockdown, we placed a large food order that enabled us to help us get through this next period. We are accepting donations of bulk food, so we have quite a few companies that support us ongoing with vegetables, fruit, bread, and so forth. Those are still coming in, but it's just the individual support from people where they might want to drop off, you know, some shopping that they've done, that type of thing, just to keep everyone as safe as we can. We're not accepting those. If people want to support us at the moment, the best way to do that is to jump online, aucklandcitymission.org.nz/donate, and you can donate there in the meantime.
So if the lockdown is extended, which a lot of people are expecting, is the bulk deliveries that you guys are getting and stuff you've got pre-ordered, will that be enough?
We think so. The team are amazing at being able to work out volumes in ahead and as best we can keep stocks up. So we will be calling on those companies that support us to see how they can do that through the period if it is extended. And when donations of cash come in from the public, we'll be spending those straight away to ensure that we can keep the orders coming in. It's really important for us that we are able to provide the support needed. So we won't turn people away. We never close our doors. We're 101 years old and we've not closed our doors in that whole time. And we certainly won't be doing that during the lockdown.
Yeah, because during this lockdown, I assume it affects people a lot differently. For the people you look after, have they said anything? Has there been any notable changes for them?
People ask, well, why all of a sudden, you know, if you're a couple of days into lockdown, why has the number of people needing support jumped so significantly? Do people not necessarily have supplies in their pantry and so forth? And often for the people that we support, they really don't. They are living in the best way that they can, but their supplies are very low. And if all of a sudden if your children are at school and you're relying on a school lunch program and they're now at home with you, if you have three children or four children, that's a lot of extra meals that you need to find in a week. Or if you have had your employment suddenly cut and you are on a casual job or, you know, just on a very low income and you don't have that income coming in, again, it's very immediate, that need. It's not as though you've got a pantry stocked full and you can kind of eke it out for a week or 2 weeks and not need to go to the supermarket. So that's very much where we come in and provide that support that's needed.
Yeah, and that's something I wanted to touch on as well, because obviously you guys are dealing with these people firsthand and supporting them. Has there been an indication of how people are feeling about this lockdown?
I think like everyone, it's a little feeling of, gosh, here we go again. And for the people who are in desperate need, are experiencing desperate need, really life is often full of challenges anyway, and those challenges become more pronounced when you don't have the systems, if you like, in place. So I can't speak for people, but I would say, like many of us, there's that sense of nervousness and that sense of hope that this doesn't last for too long.
On a slightly different note, given that you guys, that everyone's gone through a level 4 lockdown before, and I assume you guys have plans and experience with dealing with this, what are the main differences between mm-hmm. the plan and the one we had early last year?
I think we're prepared. We were dealing with the unknown then. Really, we were dealing with the unknown. And even things like at the beginning, as more and more information was coming through about when you needed PPE and the distancing that was required and so forth, we now know all of that. So we can respond much better. We've got the system set up. We've got all of our protocols ready to go. And so whilst it's not, I can't say it's as simple as just press repeat. We certainly know what we're dealing with and how to respond. Whereas in the last time we were doing the very best that we can, and we were doing a great job, but we learnt a lot along the way.
And just specifically, what does lockdown look like for those who are on the front line?
That's a great question. So I think during lockdown particularly, it's all about, the number one thing is all about keeping themselves and the people they support safe. And that safe is that practical thing, you know, all the right PPE gear, following all the protocols, scanning and everywhere, all of those things that we know that we need to do, but also keeping themselves safe emotionally. The work that they do is incredibly hard. It's incredibly taxing. And so we at the Mission really try and ensure that people are well looked after and that they've got good support networks. So if they have had a day that's been particularly tough or so forth, that there are people within the organisation that they can speak to and turn to. So very much we want to ensure that, you know, our teams that are out there really working hard are well supported by us.
That was a fundraising and reputation manager, Deb Ward, from the Auckland City Mission, speaking to Louis about how the Mission are operating under level 4 lockdown restrictions. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima and I'm your host today. We've got one more piece for you on today's show, but we'll be right back after a little break.
Many hours I was sleeping on me. Yeah, sleeping on me, I was. Reading from speaking on things like duck. If they won't lay it out, we can discuss. Tell them my Uzi gets me up. I'm out there drama, just need me a 3-3. Still Valley Boys, I don't like BB. Spread love, don't gotta be PC. Show love, it's love we receive it. To a Cali, still doing damage to the tissue. And the room is scally, getting woozy, that's just front of enemies. I got a lot on my plate. Still pushing the more through all in the phase. All gas, no braids. Trying to bring in the war to the 23 and get popping them crazy. I got a lot on my plate, working a job most days. Spending more time with my fam, still got a lot for my maze. Tell them I don't want no credit, tell them to give it to themselves. Everyone's fighting a battle, gotta get out and stay out. I ain't on about what you is, and my wrong to say you're not ruthless. Cause you're not the same with your dudes is, when you posted up hungry to do it. We all got demons, I work through mine. We all got problems, that's just life. You're wasting the platform, wasting their time. Time waits for no one, only comes when it's right. Time waits for no one, only comes when it's right. Time waits for no one, only comes when it's right. When it's right, when it's right, when it's right, when it's right.
Yes, I am the rhythm select champion. Every Monday night from 9 till 11, Dobbit and the selectors play the full range of ghetto sound. Yeah, man, from rock steady to roots reggae, beat band sound to hip hop, dub style, true to the latest dancehall vibes. Yeah, man. Rhythm selection, boy. The rhythm selection, why? The rhythm selection, boy. From 9 to 11 and 95 FM, Dobby Dam get selectors. The rhythm selection.
It's music.
95.
Original originator. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
This is 95BFM and this is The Wire. I'm Jemima and I am your host today. So for our last piece, brought to you by Jessica and Louis on the Monday Wire, conflict in Cabo Delgado with the northern region of Mozambique, has escalated in recent months. The conflict has been fought between Islamic State-affiliated militant groups and Mozambican security forces. Since it began in October 2017, over 800,000 people have been displaced, including over 300,000 children, and a further 5,000 people have died. But recently, fighting has worsened, resulting in foreign military involvement and French gas giant Total closing their $20 billion gas plant in the region. Louis was joined by independent journalist Neha Wadeka, who has spent time in Mozambique covering the conflict for the BBC and The Guardian. She began by briefly explaining what was happening in Cabo Delgado.
Yeah, so in 2017, a group of armed insurgents attacked a coastal city in the very northern province of Mozambique. The province is called Cabo Delgado. And that was the first attack in what became now, has now become a four-year insurgency. And in the beginning, these kind of armed actors, little was known about who they were, what they wanted, who they were affiliated with. And as time has passed, they pledged their allegiance to the Islamic State. And then the Islamic State has now claimed credit for the attacks that this group is perpetrating. And so these armed insurgents, many of them are local, although there are reports that there are members who are also from countries like Tanzania, which is Mozambique's neighbor to the north, as well as people say foreigners. And this group kind of goes from village to village. They burn down houses. They abduct women and children to use either as sex slaves or as fighters. And they also have been beheading villagers using machetes and other kind of horrible acts of violence. And I would say the most significant attack happened this year in March in the town of Palma, which is just, you know, close to the Tanzanian border. And what happened during this attack, it was a four-day siege, or even more than a four-day siege, where the insurgents attacked this town, which is actually the site of a $20 billion natural gas project that's being run by the French energy giant Total. And so natural resources play a big part in this. The Cabo Delgado region is rich in natural gas, gold, rubies, timber, and other really precious resources. And so from the reporting that I've done with colleagues, we've investigated the role that these natural resources and the battle over these natural resources is also playing in this insurgency.
Yeah, because you mentioned the insurgency began around 2017. Was there any indication before that that there was beliefs like this and that this kind of thing was going to happen?
You know, since kind of 2010 onwards, there were reports circulating by local religious leaders in the region. They would tell people in Maputo and in the central government that, you know, we're worried about the youth in this region being radicalized. And that is kind of a trend that's happening along the East African coast. And so the concern was that people with radical beliefs, maybe people who had been educated either in Saudi Arabia or in other parts of the Gulf or even in Sudan, they were bringing these ideas back to places like Kenya, Tanzania, and they were radicalizing locals there in a very extreme form of Islam. And so that was one of the concerns of the religious leaders in Mozambique. They said, you know, well, we're really worried that this kind of radicalization is happening. And because of the situation with natural resources and also the history of Cabo Delgado, it is a place that, you know, these radical beliefs could take hold. And the reason I say that is because this is one of the poorest regions in Mozambique. It has the poorest health, education, and employment indicators. It is really a region that has been overlooked by the central government, which is based in Maputo, over 1,000 kilometers south.
That's something I wanted to touch on, because you mentioned that the government kind of ignored people saying, like, look, there's people with these radical beliefs and they're going to radicalize youth. And then you mentioned the government overlooking. What role has the government played in this conflict?
Initially, the government was really slow to respond. So for the first couple of years of this conflict, the government actually didn't even admit that they had an issue. And so this was something that was almost being covered up. Eventually, the government really had to kind of acknowledge that there was something going on as hundreds of thousands of displaced people started moving south, either to Pemba, which is the capital city of Cabo Delgado, or north into Tanzania. And so once that became almost too explosive for the government to pretend nothing was happening, then of course they had to acknowledge the problem. Since then, the government brought in private military contractors, and that was their initial kind of physical or military response to this. They hired companies, first the Wagner Group from Russia, and then the Dick Advisory Group, which is based in South Africa. And they tried to bring these private military contractors in and hire them to deal with the problem. What ended up happening, though, was that these groups were not really prepared to fight this kind of insurgency. They were not making a lot of progress. And in the effort that they were making, they were also committing human rights abuses, which Amnesty International, the organization, documented, you know, extrajudicial killings and other kinds of abuses that these PMCs were committing. So the government now has accepted the help of external governments in dealing with this issue. So the United States has sent people to help train Mozambican forces. And then more recently, just last month, the government of Rwanda actually sent the first ground troop forces.
Because obviously Total has closed their gas plant in the region. And you mentioned that the port town's been taken over. What specific consequences are there of this?
I mean, everything. So Total was meant to come in, and that project was kind of held a lot of hopes and dreams. There was going to be development. there was going to be a lot of investment in the region. People were hoping and expecting to get jobs. And so all of that has been stopped. Right now, there's no possibility of this project continuing in the current moment. And that means that all of the progress that people were hoping for in this very kind of remote, underdeveloped part of the country is now on hold. Other major gas companies that were looking at developing projects in the region have put those decisions on hold. Of course, in addition to that, there are almost a million people, 800,000 at last count, who have been displaced from their homes. And there are another 3,000 at least who have been killed. So the consequences for the people of this region are huge.
You mentioned the displacement, and one of the figures that stood out to me was the number of displaced children. I think as of August, figures said around 336,000 children have been displaced, and some NGOs have called that a children's crisis. Do you think there's enough being done from within the government and internationally?
This is a conflict that has been slow to get attention because of the slow nature of the way that this conflict built up, as well as the crises that are happening all around the rest of the world. What was happening in Mozambique was really kind of billed as a local problem. So people said, you know, these are local guys, it's a local insurgency, this is a problem for the government. And now to see the scale and scope of the problem really tells a different story. I think, non-governmental organizations are doing as much as they can with the limited access that they have. But I do think that the government of Mozambique has been slow to issue, let's say, humanitarian visas, has been slow to try to provide access to humanitarians who are trying to reach the north, which is where the issue really is. The southern part of Cabo Delgado has been relatively secure, which has allowed NGOs and charities to set up there as a base. But that requires people to actually come down from the north where the fighting is and reach those places. And so what would be really helpful is if these organizations were able to get up into the heart of what's going on and reach people much earlier. And the government of Mozambique has not made that easy for these organizations. And so I think there's a lot more that could be done to facilitate safe access. There's also issues of kind of relocation.
Obviously there are NGOs operating in the region, albeit with difficulty. But do you think there may be need for foreign intervention beyond these NGOs?
Yeah, so I think that there are conversations going on between international governments, the European Union, the United States, with the government of Mozambique. And I think that I'm not privy to the content of those conversations, of course. My guess is that there are a lot of efforts being made for the government of Mozambique to deal with this as quickly as possible. And so I think that the things that are coming into place now with intervention from Rwanda and other countries in Southern Africa is very important. I think that the training and the kind of support hopefully being provided by the United States and European Union governments will also play a big role in trying to get this under control.
And I guess you've broadly given an overview of what's happening, of the government role and everything that's impacting people. But are there any specific examples of people you've spoke to and things that particularly stood out to you?
Oh, definitely. One of the stories that I heard just recently from a woman that I interviewed is, her name is Fatima, and she was in a town up north. And when the insurgents came, she fled. And she was only able to bring her two sons with her. And so her 10-year-old daughter was staying with her father and was lost. And no one has heard from her since. And so this colleague, this woman spoke to my colleague and I, and she traveled up to Tanzania where she tried to get refuge. And the Tanzanian government actually turned her away. And brought her back to Mozambique. And that is really against the principles of international agreements. People who are seeking refuge in other countries are meant to be given asylum or granted asylum. So being turned away at the border was traumatic for her and devastating. She really wanted to find safety. She then had to travel down to the south where I met her, and just hearing her talk about her daughter and the idea of not knowing where her daughter was or what had happened to her was just heartbreaking, and she's still looking, But I will tell you that now when she refers to her daughter, she talks about her in the past tense, you know, and so I think in her mind, she's almost already lost her. And so, I mean, that's devastating. I also spoke to a young woman who is a young mother, recently married, and she was abducted by the insurgents. She was held for over a month, and she was repeatedly sexually assaulted by one of the insurgents with her daughter in the same tent. And it's stories like that that are just, they don't leave you. They're horrifying. And the type of violence and abuse that's being perpetrated is just horrific.
Yeah, because I think these stories, especially in New Zealand, I don't think it's something we hear about. From what I've seen, there's almost been no coverage of what's happening on national news. For people who don't know that this is going on, what's happening, is there anything in particular that you have to say?
Understandably, right now, with so many different tragedies and crises going on in the world, it's very hard to feel like you can keep up with everything and to not feel overwhelmed by the amount of need and the amount of grief. But, you know, being on the ground, meeting the people in Mozambique and hearing their stories, people are asking for help and for support. And so I think, you know, the best thing to do is to try to raise awareness for people to share this information through their networks, to bring more and more scrutiny on this, because the more scrutiny is on this conflict, the more that governments and the government of Mozambique and nonprofit organizations will have to do to support the people of Cabo Delgado. And so I think that kind of awareness raising, making sure that people know what's going on, and, you know, of course, like, you know, trying to provide as much support as possible is always helpful.
That was independent journalist Neha Wadeka speaking to Louie about the time she had spent in Mozambique covering the conflict there for the BBC and The Guardian.
That was The Wire.
That was the Monday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to all of you for tuning in and listening to the show today. Thank you very much for your texts and your calls. We always love hearing from you. Huge shout out to Jessica and Louie for producing the show from home today. It was their first lockdown show, which is absolutely huge. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much to them. Massive thank you to the news team for continuing to bring you awesome quality journalism throughout this funny lockdown period that we're in now. And another huge thank you to the people who gave us their time to speak with us for the interviews we had today. I hope you're taking care out there and looking after yourselves and keeping safe in your bubble. We will catch you tomorrow with another awesome Wire. Stay tuned into BFM. We'll see you through this thing. Ka kite anō.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.